There's one other facet of this that George Bowring brings in. And, you know, if you Google Vancouver Sun, George Bowring on happiness, it's just, you know, maybe 200 words or something like that. But if you listen really hard when you're in the act of writing a poem, you get to have a happy event when you get to be the first reader of that poem, which is really interesting because people would say, well, no, you're the one who wrote it. You're not the first reader. But when it's the practice of outside and you're being used by language, you get to be the first reader. And it is a happy event.
That is a delightful idea.
And it was published in the newspaper. Can you imagine reading that in the Seattle Times?
Really?
Just stunning. There is an important distinction of how you're using projective, and you were beginning to hint at it, but I want you to elaborate a little more, because I'm visualizing the essay, although I don't have it in front of me, the essay Projective Verse, Charles Olson, 1950. And I think the word instanter might even be in all capital letters, right? And you say, slow down. It doesn't have to be as fast as you're making it out to be. Now, keep in mind, I was told that Olson wrote this essay in the spirit of Pound. So he wanted to come across as sounding like Ezra Pound. So one should read it out loud. It was told to me when I first became associated with this essay that it was meant to be read out loud. And I actually took the essay, and while I was doing overnights at the radio station, went into the production studio, would record a couple of paragraphs, go back in, hit the next record, and come back. And I listened to it over and over and over in my own voice. Yeah. But you employ an Italian painting term to get your point across. Distacco. Can you talk about that and the slowing down of it?
Okay. Distacco is actually a phrase that Kathleen Fraser uses. You make a mark on the canvas, and then you step back to see what that mark has affected. So in my notion of the projective, I say that whereas for Olson, instanter was very important, that it doesn't have to be instanter, as you said, but that the important thing is that one brush mark must lead to the next brush mark, or one language phrase must lead to the next. I have poets who are not instanter, but they struck me, namely Kathleen Fraser, and Nathaniel Mackey has talked about writing slow and fast, but he's quite deliberative in his work. And what is important in the projective verse is that the previous phrase or the mark becomes the carryover for the next mark or the language phrase. And how that makes for a different poetry is that it's really the force of the emotion and the mentality of the poet who is thereby writing eros. And so there's no constant reference back to, I feel this, I want to tell you about my feelings toward, but rather as in a projective verse, whether instanter or more slowed down, it's the movement from one language phrase to the next. And some people listening to this will say, okay, I get it, it's associative. It's not really associative, because associative means that I'm more of a psychological subject, like, I'll think of love, and then I might think of the bad love poems I wrote, and then I might think of my first boyfriend or whatever. That's associative, because you're kind of letting your psychology move around. Whereas projective really is more like Olson says it is, where you're in the event of the poem, and you're not so much going back to, what do I think, what do I remember, but you're sort of moving with the commitment of the initial perception into the next perception. Into the next perception.
I'm reminded of a line from Michael McClure's Dolphin Skull that goes, free association is a red-blue tongue up the ass. She looks like Elizabeth Taylor. The mind is there and somewhere else. And he goes on from that point, which is just wonderful. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a rebuttal to the people who say this is stream of consciousness, this is automatic writing or whatever. Yeah. It's deeper than that. I get that. And of course, I agree with you. I'd like to go back to HD and Pound, because as I'm reading your book and preparing for this and going over Canto 4 again and reading it to my beloved, she's like, this is Ezra Pound. I never had that notion that his, mm-hmm. his poetry was this amazing. And so we start, and she says, well, who was he, basically? And I've had that question before, and, you know, to some people I would say, Google Ezra Pound, you could probably find something. But I told her, well, essentially he invented modernism. And that's a generally held belief, but you say it's a little more complicated than that. In fact, it was a debt to HD mm-hmm. and to her same-sex love, which mm-hmm. is fascinating.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I have, my book has a very adventurous thesis and theses. And one of the ideas in the book is that the, well, it's complicated because I believe that there is a, what's the word I'm searching for? Ecology in poetry. So it's an ecology of energy. And to pull up another phrase from Olson, which I think is important, is poetry is energy from where the poet got it by way of the poem all the way over to the reader. And one of the things that Pound insisted on, but many of his later poets who would, even someone like Charles Bernstein, I think would say, well, of course, he was part of the mix of modernism. He was a big inventor. So my argument is that sexual love is a founding block in our existence, and that a poetry to be real, to be emotionally powerful, can't walk around sexual love. Now, once you've written sexual love and you've got a kind of eros going, you may not need to constantly return, to, as I said, to being in love. So I think what Pound through HD accomplished, or HD and Pound accomplished, was that they were intensely in love with each other. And I think it is oftentimes misunderstood the degree to which Pound was really sold and besotted with HD, partly because he was had a wandering eye or a wandering self, but she was very important to him. And together, she created the first imagist verse. They were erotic verse, and there was this eros that existed apart from a love earth, through a set of associative, projective language. He recognized it. There's something really terrific in this, and he called it imagism. And there's been a lot of disapproval from feminist critiques who feel like he appropriated HD, appropriated what she had done. And so my argument is slightly different. Like, wow, look at HD's work, written partially to a same-sex lover, because she was bisexual, and one of her most important early love relationships was with a woman. In fact, she claims that as her singularly most erotic love, at least at one point in her letters. So she's creating this verse in relationship to a same-sex lover. And Pound recognizes that this is what he's been after. This is the modern moment that he's been looking for. And so then he creates imagism as a more generalized set of poetic principles. But my argument is that without the intensity, the sexual love that motivated the verse, that in fact perhaps this new form would not have been created. It's literally that magic language, the mobility of language, when one is intensely erotic, that enabled HD to write love poetry as powerful as any man. One of her models was Sappho, but it was a number of other Greek lyricists in which same-sex love was, in fact, normative within the idiom that the love poetry was written. And interestingly enough, this love poetry tended not to be, I am so in love with you, but would start like, I, Harmonia, feel this. So it's almost like an objectification, like I, who am this entity. And also, if you look closely at Sappho's verse, and this is a big argument about Sappho, is the I, is her lover that projects itself there, is that introspective? Is that that kind of lover who's reflecting on him or herself, on the beloved that we find in later love poetry? Is that really there, or is she really, because she's writing in a community of lovers, a more oral poetry, is she in fact stepping outside of, because she never went there, because she was before it, the kind of introspective, self-important lover, so that there's a freedom to write love in her verse, not through a traditional Western modality? I don't know, that gets fairly complicated.
Well, one of the lines that says it very succinctly in the book is that Pound was struggling to attain the qualities already present in H.D.'s writing. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, that Pound needed to address sexual love to write the cantos. Mm-hmm. Without that ability, the cantos doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's my thesis. And I'd be curious what various Pound scholars would say. But I track it through his writing and show the struggle to write the cantos, and that he starts moving toward them by writing an homage to Sextus Propertius, who was a famous Latinate love poet. So he takes on the persona of Propertius and he begins writing catalogs. And it's through this kind of cataloging of erotic modalities, a separation really, not himself, but through Propertius that he approaches it, and that eventually, fairly soon thereafter, he writes Canto 4, which is really the first canto that leads to a revision when he writes Cantos 1, 2, and 3 over, because they had existed in what he regarded as not what he was trying to do. And Canto 4 is extremely erotic. There's erotic scenarios, there's a kind of imagistic writing going on. And in fact, biographically, and I could certainly be corrected on this flack, because I didn't do a lot of biographical research just when the occasion presented itself, that in fact, around the time of Canto 4, he is moving out of his first marriage with Dorothy Shakespeare and encountering other love affairs. And as the biography portrays, and I'm sure I could be slapped on the hand from any number of feminist critics, I regard myself as a feminist critic, but that indeed he's finding some kind of sexual love relationship that he hadn't had previously. One of the things about Pound, and again, I haven't done enough work in deep biography, but it's in a lot of the biographies, is that he actually didn't have a consummated sexual love relationship for quite some time, including into his marriage. Now, that may be wrong. I may not have read recent enough sources, but the consummation with a lover who was resonant for him was happening at the time he wrote Canto 4.
A late bloomer, let's say.
Late bloomer.